Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean for the show called Getting It Done. For some time, I've wanted to do a show like this that's featuring two distinct audiences. One young lady, they come from two different forms of entertainment, but both experience the same kind of treatment. And their names are Josephine Baker, and the other person's name is Dorothy Dandridge. Both young ladies experienced a lot in the field of racism. So today you'll get an opportunity to hear more than just a presentation about general racism in a general terms, but more in the light of a specific person or two specific people. Today's presentation is on these two outstanding black performers who have lived during this period of segregation and Jim Crowism. Both, in their own way, worked real hard to receive acclaim in not only the world, but in the entertainment business and life in general in the white society. I'm speaking of course, Josephine Baker and Dorothy Dandridge, both singers, dancers, and also movie stars. I chose these two ladies because we have been presenting the effects of racism in general. And now you're going to see how racism affected these two ladies. Start off with Josephine Baker.
Tonight, Josephine Baker and Intimate Poetry. Starting her career in the United States during the rough and tumble years of the Roaring Twenties, the magnificent Josephine Baker became a star of countless glamorous shows, including Paris's Folly. Paris's Folly's Bergère.
Well, for some reason, my computer is not cooperating.
And it's going back and dealing with something else other than
just Sam Cooke. And let me see if I can cut this down and I can talk so I don't have to be hearing Sam Cooke. I don't know why, but you see, Some of these particular vehicles that we call radio technology don't always cooperate with you. So bear with me while I try to figure out what's going on with this doggone thing. Sorry for the sound that you're not getting. It's just because I'm trying to figure out what's going on here. And this is bringing me to places I do not want to go. And here's Josephine Baker, I hope. Okay, let's see what happens here.
United States during the rough and tumble years of the Roaring Twenties, the magnificent Josephine Baker became a star of countless glamorous shows, including Paris's Folies Bergère and New York's Ziegfeld Follies.
She brought the air of Africa with her on top of the effervescence and the style of the 20s.
They route to dancing her way into history and into the hearts of men and women on both sides of the Atlantic with the infamous Banana Dance. Josephine also became an important and valuable icon to women of all colors and to all all black Americans during the racial struggles of the 1950s.
It is horrible to grow up without equality, feeling that you're a second-class citizen.
In addition to being a star on the world stage, Josephine shared her heart and soul with the world as she publicly adopted children of all races and colors in hopes of bringing the people of the world closer together. Coming up is the story of a dancer, a singer, and an actress, but most importantly, a world-class citizen who entertained millions while fighting the good fight, Miss Josephine Baker. I'm Arsenio Hall. Tonight, Josephine Baker and Elizabeth Fortune.
Josephine Baker was, without question, one of the most beautiful, daring, exciting, and world-loved entertainers that ever graced a stage, ever.
When you look at the Diana Rosses and the Madonnas of the world, Josephine Baker, she kind of paved the road. I mean, long before they were doing their thing, long before Bette Midler, long before Madonna, long before Diana Ross, long before Patti LaBelle, long before RuPaul, there was Josephine Baker.
It's nice to see you. It's been a long time since you've been back on New Zealand, hasn't it?
Yeah, no, only 2.5 years ago.
Well, of course, I'm thinking of the fact that originally you came from the United States.
Yes, St. Louis.
St. Louis, Missouri. Actually, St. Louis, Missouri at one time was French, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I thank you for remembering.
Josephine Baker was born in St. Louis, Missouri in 1906 by a black mother and a white German father. Her given name was Frieda. A long way from the legendary Josephine Baker.
She's a black woman who came out of segregated America, whose mother was a washerwoman, who pulled herself up and made opportunity for herself.
Josephine's world as a little girl in St. Louis was very difficult. It was very challenging. It was very deprived. Her family was extremely poor, and she was a little urchin. I mean, she was a real Charles Dickens kind of human being, you know, out there fending for herself, trying to help to take care of the family, you know, bringing home the bacon, so to speak.
I occasionally found work babysitting for white families. Every time it was the same. I would be warned, be sure not to kiss the baby.
It was, you know, a pretty rough time in St. Louis. It was tremendously challenging, you know, facing that racism every day, facing the fact that there's constantly an entire society saying that you're not good enough. You know, you're not pretty enough. You're not good enough. You're not white enough.
In 1917, at the age of 11, Josephine Baker witnessed firsthand an explosion of racial tensions spreading across the country as the streets of St. Louis erupted in violence.
It was a highly pitched, very volatile racial scene going on in and around St. Louis at that time. And in fact, Josephine was a child during the St. Louis riots, where it was a massacre. I mean, there were many, many, many Negro people killed at that time.
The entire black community appeared to be fleeing like ants from a scattered ant heap. Someone shouted that a white woman was raped, and although I didn't understand the meaning of the word, I knew that it was the ultimate catastrophe. Mama quickly turned my face away.
Josephine's childhood was a very difficult one, leading her to leave St. Louis by the age of 15, already having been married twice.
When Josephine was 11 and 12, she was very difficult. She was even working on the street, on Market Street, and going with men for $1. The mother was horrified, and that's why Josephine's mother married Josephine at 13 years of age. She has two early marriages,
They don't work out, and she doesn't hesitate to leave the guys. And again, women at that particular time weren't supposed to walk out on this. They weren't supposed to walk out on marriages, but Josephine figures, what the heck? And then she just pushes herself on.
Josephine's first step into show business was as a backstage dresser in 1919, traveling with vaudeville's Dixie Steckers. And by 1921, Josephine was headed to New York with Cicely and Blake's Shuffle Along.
Baker wants to audition for the chorus, and she goes in to audition. And the way that Baker tells the story is that she was rejected because she was too young, too thin, and too dark. She later went back and she auditioned again wearing a very light powder, and she was hired to work backstage. She then watched every night the movements and the maneuvers of the chorus girls, because she knew that one night or another some chorus girl wasn't going to be able to go on, and then she might have her chance.
It was back on the road again. I thought someone is sure to get sick. The thing to do is to learn all the songs and dance them. Every night I pray, Lord, I'm not praying for anything dramatic, but please do something.
If she didn't take total advantage of whatever small window of opportunity she had, it may not come again. It was very difficult at that time. Certainly it was very competitive. That she got in the show at all was almost like haphazard, that some girl fell out and she happened to know the song and they threw her on and she was funny. So they let her stay. You always had to push the envelope. You always did. We grew up knowing that we had to. In order, this was survival.
The chorus girls at this time were light black women. They used to call them light, bright, damn near white women. Very close to that white ideal. Josephine Baker, when she gets on the chorus line, she is really the brownest one on the line. And I think that Baker felt that in this lineup of light-skinned women, in order for her to get attention, in order for her to be appreciated, she had to have more energy. She had to have more razzle-dazzle. She had to have more pizzazz. And at the end, first number, when everyone stopped freezing to get the applause, she broke the line and went and did what was then called a nigger routine, which was absolutely away from Shuffle Along. Shuffle Along suddenly was sophisticated. You could have believed it was white people performing.
Wherever we went, we brought down the house, playing to mixed audiences in neighborhoods where blacks had never performed. At $125 a week, I was the best paid girl in the chorus.
After 2 years of standing out in the chorus line of Shuffle Along, Cicely and Blake wrote a leading role, especially for Josephine, in their next smash hit, Chocolate Dandy. However, after that, it would be more than a decade before Josephine performed again on American soil.
She was a wild thing, you know, and a lot of it was really just impetuous in her being who she was. When I saw her in the footage that I saw, what cued me in on how deeply she needed to be loved was the shoulder. She was like so cute. It was all, you know, not being okay, cute, I'm so cute. And then little by little, you saw this sophistication coming over her, and it became more inclusive and yielding to her audience. And, you know, then she knew what she was doing. But early on, everything was fueled by a fear of poverty, a fear of not being loved.
Chuck, 25 years ago, you went all the way over to Paris, 3,000 miles away, and sort of went on a limb. What prompted you to go over there? Was it to the desire to further your career, more or less?
No, I don't think it was that, because for the reason that I was unknown when I was here in America. It doesn't mean that I'm very, very little unknown now.
You certainly are.
But even so, I thought by going to Paris, and then of course I wanted to go to Paris because everybody loves Paris and knows about the city of art.
I dreamed of going to Paris ever since I saw a photograph of the Eiffel Tower. It looked very different from the Statue of Liberty. But what did it matter? What was the good of having the statue without the liberty, the freedom to go where one chose if one was held back by one's color?
It was a very interesting time in Europe, because there was a whole
sense of looking to this primitive, what was supposed to be a primitive culture, and taking from, extracting from it what was exciting. And Josephine brought with it her own very specific expressions in dance. She brought the air of Africa with her on top of the effervescence and the style of the 20s, which said a lot to me as a choreographer, that she was free, high-spirited, spontaneous. She was primitive enough and sophisticated enough and exotic enough that they could see a lot of what they recognized in the African culture that they liked.
In 1925, Josephine's dream of going to Paris came true when she was asked to perform in the authentic Negro Revue, La Revue Negre, a show that would turn the passion of Europe to the boiling point and launch Josephine's spectacular career.
Her first recognition in Paris was with La Revue Negre, more specially in the dance number La Danse de Sauvage, which was so sexual that everything went on but penetration, with Joe Alex, a black African, who had been brought to give some more color to La Revue Negre.
Joe and Alex choreographed the dance, and of course he partnered her in it as well, and he was the one who carried her on stage on his back. She was doing the splits on top of his shoulders, and he laid her down on the stage, and a scream of salutation burst through the audience.
Driven by dark forces I didn't recognize, I improvised, crazed by the music. The overheated theater filled to the bursting point, the scorching eye of the spotlight. Each time I leapt, I seemed to touch the sky, and when I regained Earth, it seemed to be mine alone.
What happened with Josephine Baker, the extraordinary thing, is that once she really was on that stage and she saw that audience, she knew intuitively that this was something that had been awaiting her all of her life. It was as if her whole life led up to that moment, and she just tore up that stage. She was bold in a way and daring in a way that had never been seen before. For a woman to come out on stage naked in a split, upside down, being carried on a man's back with just some feathers, honey, the world was gagging, child. Can you imagine? I mean, there must have been some heart attacks in that audience. There had to be. They didn't know what they, I mean, I'm sure the first night she did that, they probably had to, this Paris stayed open all night long because they were just gossiping all the, honey, have you seen it? Have you seen it, child?
Paris was reeling with the heat generated by Josephine's African sensuality. And at only 19 years old, she was already more than just another performer.
Josephine Baker pushed an envelope, not only for black women, but for women, period, that she was coming out with pure freedom. She was coming out with no limitations, whether it's on how she gyrated and moved her body or her nakedness. She was proud of herself, and she loved herself in a way that allowed women to see the beauty in their own selves. And the whole time, she wore her womanhood like a shroud that made people bow down to it. And that's something that we as women need to remember and not run away from, that we can embrace womanhood, we can embrace femininity, and still go out there and kick some ass, because she did it her whole life.
Part of the wonder that is Josephine Baker has always been uncovering the mysteries of her life, which are often hidden in the myth and the legend. But all of it is magic.
It's a bit like beauty's in the eye of the beholder. Maybe truth is also in the eye of the beholder. And I think we want the truth. We don't just want the myth or the legend. But sometimes the myth and the legend both are so strong and say something else to us and become sign, symbol, or metaphor. So we hold on to that as well. It's often hard to sort out the woman who's buried in the myth and the legend. But the myth, the legend, the woman, all three together say something to us, and they say something to us about the 20th century, they say something to us about America, and they also say something to us about race in America.
I had to succeed. I would never stop trying, never. That's why I spent 30 minutes every morning rubbing my body with a half a lemon to lighten my skin, and just as long preparing a mixture for my hair. I couldn't afford to take chances. Josephine Baker was the ugly duckling because she was not light, fair skin. She was a chocolate dandy. She was a brown-skinned gal. And that was not considered beautiful. No matter what you looked like, that color made you unattractive. Josephine Baker changed all of that. She changed all of that. That's probably when white people over in Europe started getting tans, I bet you. I will bet you when Josephine Baker came out there showing all that brown satin sugar, honey, that's probably when the white folks started getting naked and rubbing grease on them, honey, trying to look like her. She gave us a sense of ourselves. And in an outrageous, glamorous way, but truly a sense of ourselves and that we were beautiful. So for that reason, black women always will hold her in very high esteem.
Josephine certainly was beautiful. And by 1925, everyone in Paris knew it. The French had fallen in love again, this time with the talented daughter of a St. Louis washerwoman.
She delighted in this, and she told stories of having received 46,000 fan letters within 2 years and 2,000 marriage proposals. And again, it probably wasn't 46,000 fan letters, and it probably wasn't 2,000 marriage proposals, but there were some marriage proposals, and there were some fan letters, and there was this extraordinary woman at the center of all of this.
What was your first big break there?
Is that?
Yeah.
On the chair?
On the chair, you were running into it.
By her 20th birthday, the name Josephine Baker would be etched into the neon Parisian skyline, declaring her the star of the world-famous Folies Bergeres, where she would dance her way into history.
At the Folies Bergeres, the rage is Josephine Baker, daughter of a St. Louis washerwoman. Her loose-limbed abandon epitomizes Paris at night.
An enormous flower door would be lowered slowly from the rafters and settle among the musicians. The lid would open, revealing me crouched in the mirrored interior. I would straighten up and begin to dance half nude.
I think the nakedness was made a big difference for the Folies Bergeres to other shows around the country and around the world.
For the next 2 years, Josephine continued to create a wave of shock and delight with a dance as comical as it was sensual. One for which she would always be remembered.
The thing that caused the most comment opening night and for 15 years to come was by banana waistband. 16 bananas pointing comically toward the ceiling were attached to a belt slung low around my hips to accentuate my forward and backward movements.
It was a blessing that Josephine wasn't alive when I did Josephine Baker.
The Theatre Royal Stockholm is proud to present at the opening of a European tour the magnificent, the untamable Miss Josephine Baker!
If people see the real banana dance and the eccentricity, that absolute fire that comes out of her steps, nobody's done since. It was her own personal expression and what she felt about the music. I mean, a lot of it wasn't choreographed. It was just, okay, Josephine, here's your bananas, get out of there and do your thing. What made it very specific and original was that she really infused her personality in it. You know, it was not about, I'm doing these steps correctly and all of that. It was, here's who I am. You know, oop-oop-we-doop. I mean, she had Josephine Baker. She created oop-oop-we-doop. I mean, that's it. You know, without Josephine, there would be no oop-oop-we-doop.
If it's true that Jerry Lewis is a genius in France, there was a Jerry Lewis, Jim Carrey thing about her. And that's unusual, considering she wasn't a stand-up. She was a dancer. But this lady, at any moment, could break into something very silly and very physically silly.
What Josephine did naturally, Catherine Dunham and Martha Graham and all those choreographers, you know, took and turned into a technique.
With great success already behind her, the future awaited, soon to be embraced by love and the first man she could count. In 1926, one of the people who got very close to Josephine was Giuseppe Appicino. He called himself a count. Others knew the truth and called him Pepito.
I'll never forget the face, the delicate features, the lively thoughtful eye, the glinting monocle, the sensitive sardonic mouth, Count Albertina. Why couldn't I fall in love with an orphan?
I think that Albertina was the person who made her. He showed her the ropes. He showed her how to be a star, how to manipulate publicity. He was the business manager, but she was the woman at the front of it.
Yes, he was inevitable. He would beat her, he would be the chooser, and that she would come beg his forgiveness on her knees. It was fabulous for her. Any entertainer wish to have someone like Pepito in his or her life.
He was a gigolo. He was a con man. But they were both performers. They were both people in the rough and tumble of life and show business and publicity. They were very well matched for a while.
Whatever Pepito was, there's no denying he became an effective manager of Josephine's career, landing her a starring role in the 1927 silent film, The Siren of the Tropics, the first of her three motion pictures.
Josephine Baker, when she was in France in the 30s, she did movies like Zuzu and Princess Tam Tam. And in those movies, there were parts of them in which she was glamorized. The movies also were compromised. They titillated audiences with the idea of interracial romance, but always pulled back at the crucial moment. But she was a star in those movies. In America in the 1930s, if you saw a Hollywood movie, you're going to see black women playing the giggling maids. Hattie McDaniel working in Hollywood films of the 30s, or Louise Beavers playing these big, hefty mammy figures. So Baker was very aware of the way that America still regarded its black female entertainment.
How I love to tell you how I love you.
Pepito's vision of Josephine as a world-class performer didn't end when the camera stopped rolling. He continued by securing a recording contract for Josephine.
She cut her first record in the autumn of 1926, and she'd only been in Paris for a year. And you can hear her voice on that. It's this little, lilting, piping voice. But already she had a very interesting thing. She knew how to sing happy songs with a sad expression. It's rather interesting. It's something she did throughout her career.
Although Josephine's voice continued to develop over the years, there was one song she would sing thousands of times throughout the world after introducing it in the 1930 Casino de Paris show.
One of the plots in the Casino de Paris show was about a native girl who falls in love with a white man and wants him to take her back to civilization. Charming secret, but something was missing until our composer, Vincent Scotto, saved the day when he arrived, wildly waving a music sheet. It was Je Douze Amour. Leaning over the piano, I joined in. Two loves have I, my country and Paris. I felt a sudden lump in my throat.
Je Douze Amour, your Paris is
Pepito and I weren't married. We had to book separate hotel rooms thanks to one of those puritanical American laws that promote hypocrisy.
Unfortunately, the show wasn't a big success. Josephine's voice was too small for the theater. People said they couldn't hear her. The reviewers were hostile towards her.
She was not well received by the critics. I mean, Time magazine had that famous review where Time referred to her as this Negro wench.
I blame Pepito for not negotiating a better contract. After all, this wasn't Europe, and Parity was unbeatable. We had a violent scene. At wit's end, he packed his bags and left for France. But perhaps it was for the best. I had already left him once, fed up with his jealousies.
Unknown to Josephine, Pepito was dying of cancer. And by September 1937, Pepito had passed away. 2 months later, Josephine married her third husband, Jean Lyon, a moderately successful businessman, and became a French citizen. Josephine's dream of having children was becoming a reality.
I want to become a housewife and have at least 6 children. I mustn't let the real things in life pass me by.
But just over a year later, Josephine filed for divorce from Jean Lyon after being told her dream could never come true.
One day I felt a twinge of pain in my stomach, then sudden agony. The doctor hurried in. There was nothing he could do. I lost my baby. I lost the only thing that bound Jean Lyon and me together. I knew then that Jean and I were through.
Your favorite song, of course, is True Love Have I. It must be. It's the one you started with, right?
Yes, now I always sing it. I started during the war, all the GIs and the British forces, and that's when the French forces, because I was big French during the war.
By 1939, a new role for Josephine was being written as World War II pounded at the borders of France, leaving Josephine with the choice of fleeing or staying and helping the country she had come to love.
She could easily have gone back to America then. Of course she could. But I don't think there was any doubt in her mind that she wanted to stay and fight for France.
Josephine's participation in World War II would be defined as a recruited member in the underground forces of the French Resistance.
She went to Marseille, where she was appearing in a show at Christmas 1940. And by then, the resistance was beginning to get a little bit of an organization. They asked her to go to North Africa, base herself there in Casablanca, and help them. The sort of things she did, she went 3 times to Spain to help carry messages. What those messages were, we'll never know.
Just as art imitates life, life imitates art. As Josephine was asked to be a James Bond-like courier of secret invisible ink messages written inside her musical charts.
As a child, the sight of cripples in the street turned my stomach. Now, years later, the memory of those maimed bodies returned. War was an anonymous, brutal machine. War was injustice.
For the next 28 months, Josephine was hospitalized with a series of life-threatening infections. But immediately upon returning to health, Josephine was once again performing for the troops and insisting that the audiences be integrated with black and whites together.
We've got to show that blacks and whites are treated equally in the army, or else what's the point of waging war on Hitler?
In 1945, Europe was liberated, and shortly thereafter, Josephine, at age 39, was awarded France's most prestigious medal.
She herself said after the war, "I just did what I had to do, what I thought I had to do. There wasn't any doubt about it." But there aren't many new dancers from the music hall who are awarded the Croix de Guerre and the Rosette de la Résistance.
With the war over, Josephine once again looked to love. What happens? By marrying French band leader Joe Bouillon in 1947, a man who might one day fulfill her dream of starting a family. Together, they returned to the United States. This time, Josephine was ready for the U.S., even if the U.S. wasn't ready for Josephine.
She was speaking out on stage. She was speaking in a way that was condemning racism while she was entertaining you. That way she had your full attention.
Of course, there's a whole incident at the Stork Club in 1951 when Josephine Baker goes to the Stork Club for a meal and goes with friends. They get to the Stork Club and they order. And then Josephine Baker's ordered a steak and she's waiting and it doesn't arrive. And after an hour or so, she became so angry, She got up from her table. Of course, she breezes past the columnist, Walter Winchell. And then she called up Walter White, the executive secretary of the NAACP, and said that the store club had not served her.
Walter Winchell, the most powerful man in the media, was outraged when Josephine blamed him for not coming to her rescue in the press. A war of words was on.
Turning to someone right at the top of my drop-dead list, Joseph Boney Baker, self-proclaimed Joan of Arc of the colored races and communist sympathizer.
I think it was a little bit more than just an incident. I think she went there looking for trouble. I think she knew that it was a whites-only club and that this was likely to happen.
It is horrible to grow up without equality, feeling that you're a second-class citizen. And I think that she carried part of that with her always. And she wanted to make it better.
After the store club, this made headlines. The NAACP picketed the store club. And what Josephine Baker, in essence, was saying, that in the most sophisticated of circles, in the most sophisticated of cities, New York, racism was still there.
She was a person that embodied absolutely, if you don't stand for something, you fall for anything.
I don't think she would ever have imagined the terrible effect it had on her career, this hate campaign that was launched against her by Winchell afterwards, which ended, of course, with her having her visa taken away, and she wasn't allowed back in America till 1960.
The Star Club was not only Walter Winchell's favorite night spot. It was also frequented by Winchell's close friends, the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover, who started a file and an investigation into Josephine Baker and what she was saying about the United States.
The United States is not a free country, believe me. I'm not jealous of those who live there. I've heard that steps are being taken to prohibit my return to the United States.
Remember that we're talking now in the early 50s. This is really, we're on the eve of the civil rights movement. We're really not there yet.
Although the FBI and others seemed determined to taint Josephine's reputation, the NAACP realized how significant she and her message were. By holding a parade in Harlem and naming May 20th, 1951 as Josephine Baker Day, her career, however, would never recover. Already having hopes that she and her husband, Joe Bouillon, would one day adopt as many as four children, Josephine purchased the impressive French country chateau, Les Milans. By 1954, Josephine dreamt of being a universal mother, raising children from all over the world at Les Milans. Her first two children, Yamamoto Akio and Jeannot, were adopted while she was performing in Japan.
The fact is that when she starts to make a family, because she couldn't have her children, so she decided to do that in memory of her past, and she wanted to demonstrate to the world that children with different color, different religion, could be brother. So that's why having black brother, yellow brother, Indian brother, white, that makes her a universal mother.
As you can see, Josephine didn't stop at two or four. Almost everywhere she went, she adopted another child with the goal of giving them a home and showing the world that people of all races and religions could live as one. She called them her rainbow tribe.
She said, I have a big family. I have a little town. I want to make like a universal town, international town for you and for others.
Although few questioned Josephine's sincerity in creating her rainbow tribe, as the family grew, so did the controversy surrounding it. And the debt of turning Les Milans into a tourist attraction was becoming a growing burden as well.
Sometimes my mother let us go in with her near the border of the park and to speak with the people. It was looking like to be monkeys in a cage. First, it was an instinct for her. She looked whatever in an orphanage or places, and I like this one, I like this one. And tried legally, illegally, to take back to France those children. And after, in 1957, we became officially legally adopted.
Her vision for the Rainbow Tribe was, I'm afraid, a very naive one. One has to say that. the idea that you can gather children together to prove that children, people can live in racial harmony, that is a very difficult thing to do. And some people might say that it was a somewhat cruel experiment. But behind all of that, there is so many good memories when we're all together, playing with children, going to school. It was a good experience, very good experience. So I'm very proud of that, very, very proud.
Josephine's husband Joe Bouillon pleaded with her to stop adopting after the eighth child, and before the financial strain of Le Milan ruined her. She didn't, and sadly, the marriage ended, and Josephine continued on by herself.
Alors ça a été un défilé incessant de gens qui venaient. Ils étaient tous au courant que les Milland allaient probablement être vendus. Elles n'étaient pas encore vendues. Il y avait eu un jugement qui enlevait les Milland à Joséphine, mais en tous les cas, ça n'était pas encore officiel, si vous voulez. Alors, elle était à la fois bouleversée et heureuse. Bouleversée parce que les Milland, pour elle, c'était une grande partie de sa vie.
In 1969, this famous photo of Josephine was taken on the steps of Le Milan after it was sold in an auction. Refusing to leave, Josephine sat in the rain for hours. For the first time, the world saw a tragic figure who had become old and tired of fighting.
She wasn't a woman prepared, you know, for money. She was not a good businesswoman. But after, when you think you have your family behind you, you say, okay, we lost that, so what? We can continue another place, if we are all together.
Josephine and her children were able to stay together, thanks to the warm friendship offered to her by Princess Grace of Monaco, who donated a home to the Rainbow Tribe, ensuring that they would never be homeless again. With her family now safe, it was time for Josephine to get back on her feet with a new show at Paris's Babino. Josephine was coming back, but it wouldn't be easy.
She wants to go to Paris and to make the show in Paris. And it is Babino.
Babino was classic Josephine. Big costumes, bright colors, and beautiful music. Josephine rehearsed the dance and musical numbers with renewed vigor. She was ready to show Paris that she was still the magnificent Josephine Baker. But at age 69, people around her were already concerned.
These 6 days.
But it was a
I think that's what still fascinates people today. The whole idea that no matter what a nation or people or someone can tell you that you shouldn't do, that you can't do, you just got to go within yourself, like David did, and just write it and go right down that road.
I've used up quite a bit of time. And what's so gratifying,
I wanted to do Dorothy Dandridge, but
it's because of the time that we have left, it's going to be virtually impossible for me to do that particular person.
So I'll have to save that for next week or on Monday. That's next week. And see who else I could use to cover that last bit of time that we have left. And let's see who I think I might be able to pull up to be a part of that. Now, we have somebody who's still alive. However, she's getting up in age. Still a fantastic thing. And this one will last pretty close to the amount of time. This is another female singer. I don't remember her ever. She's a heck of an entertainer. One of Patti LaBelle. Let's listen to what happened in her life, too.
I just don't like to be in the booth. I like to just come out with a band of singers. That's the first thing you hear me in the booth.
It's something that just pierces, you know, my emotions when I hear her sing. Because I also know how much she loves.
A lot of times, experiencing my chosen, you know, for a long time, and I'm trying to do it well, trying to do it better, just trying to do it. And when I sing now, I hold the notes longer now than I did 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and I roll the score better than I did 5 years ago. The older I get, the stronger I get, the more powerful my voice is. The thing is, it's like I can taste like a bottle of wine, a whole bottle of wine. See, this is a vintage voice, vintage experience. One of the lessons that kind of developed was here is the fact that did not that she appreciated it because she knows that it's necessary.
I was born in Philadelphia 57 years ago. Patricia Williams Hope. That's my name. Some people call me Matt, Patty, Patsy. Some people really know me, Patsy. One of the first things that I remember, I say that I knew was she was born. She was a little baby, she was a pretty little girl. But technically, I was not me. Some of them had a very dark skin of white. With a wide nose, my nose is thick. You know, so it made me feel a little better about myself because I had nothing. And my mother, a little house. I'll show you my book. This house is, I did everything here. I learned to cook here. I learned to love here. So all my neighbors and actually, I'm just a neighbor, but I'm not all of my neighbors. So much I do, I got to do something else. I grew up listening to Gloria Lynn and James Moody when I was really young, and I took a room and pretended that was my family and sing my face up.
And I knew that I could sing, but I wasn't going to let anybody else know. And then I went to church, and then I was a wonderful choir director. My mom being the choir director, you're going to be on the choir, you know. So just at some rehearsal, trying to sing, you were in the choir. My mom didn't decide we were going to sing that special language. And my mother said, now, who can lead this song? And Patty said, actually, let me tell you, we call it Patty. So Patty said, Jackie, can I try it? You know, so my mom said, yeah, well, come on up. You know? So she got up and she started to sing the song.
That was part of the chorus, looking out at the people and their response to the way she was singing the song. And I could tell that that they were being touched by the emotion that she brought to the song.
So the people were just stood up at the end. That was Black Girls and Pain.
Everybody was talking about that. Read, she was saying.
Panic. And those that came to my house on Diamond or Oregon and Georgia. Yeah, big old beautiful porch. This porch looking cool. All day long, I can see that. And hold on. And she was just going to say, but she said, she barely came that time. I thought it was going to say. And she was going to say, when she was a child. And she grew up proud. Love to hear her. You talking like that. She said, last day, I can almost see her down now. But she couldn't get it. We had never seen nobody think like that before. And it's amazing, too. I knew that I could sing, but I didn't have a clue of what it was. I didn't want
to sing. There was no vehicles at that particular time to educate, especially the American.
Show at our school, and I said, you never walk alone, you have to teach yourself. They were like, after that pushing, then when she was just getting the clothes, I was sitting around by a door out there with the other way, Sarah Nash, Mel Hendricks, and the other thing. And we became the result. We come out of high school because I always say we had stardust in our eyes. And so we became aware of the business, but this became more serious. Patty was more serious, you know, about singing. We went to a recording studio in Philadelphia called Abby Robinson. He was also the producer and the leading of whatever that would have felt. And when we went to him, the first thing he said after seeing us is that I'm too black. So he did not want to give us a chance. And so Montague, who was our manager at the time, was Mr. Robinson. And he'd be here and sing. And so we did Danny Boy's Bringing Your Whole Clone. And Honey, All the Black and Ugly Left My Baby. After that, he would say, you were ugly, you didn't say you were black, always, always green. We were originally called to do that. But we couldn't join the union because there were another set of women who already joined. They were traveling in Europe, and they were of another persuasion. So the president of the record company changed Patty's name to Patty LaBelle. Patty LaBelle, and because this was, you know, he was so sick. We were able to work at the house. Addie's voice was very clear and bell-like, and sort of a husky outcome. Cindy has the, and not to discredit her sound in any way, but she had sort of the monotone voice, and I had the high voice. We were doing the first time at the Light of the Jungle. I had no idea that they were a bad thing. What? Oh, God. I remember the appearance at American Bandstand. We had bell bottom pants with stripes going around the bottom, sailor's suit. And we were doing the first song, I Saw Mark in the Jungle. And we felt like stars. I mean, Dick Clark Bandstand. Here we are, dancing songs. We all had our hair, this curl. We were all going to the kitchen. 7 years old, and my hair wasn't all tight. And with our little makeup and just lifting them down. We were unique at the time for women in the industry because we could take songs, right? We'd never walk alone and sing them. We had to have voices. Being accepted at the Apollo to me, this was a big step in my life. Because, you know, on stage at the Apollo was like, you made it. And if you can get through that night, you really made it through. Those children will pay or cheer that you can do something. But let you know that you shouldn't be a person that you did. But they gave us a standing stage.
I was on the stage. And they were outstage. And when I was about 16 or 17,
there was a little running after Patti LaBelle, who was a big fan. And he became our first president of our
Their harmonies were so tight. You know, I remember not knowing anything. We used to admire the fact that they were both fathers. You know, because their harmonies were so strong. It was an audience for the daughter.
Who wears something first and who looks the best, and Patti LaBelle was unique because we didn't really wear gowns, we wore sort of little lacy garner shop dresses, you know, that were real crazy, and you know, we didn't have a lot of money, but we still knew what to buy to make it seem as if it was a lot of money. Oh, that little pickle was coming in. And see what we were wearing. And they would go out and buy the same outfit. I think we got the real ones. I don't know what that was. Just gold or Mason. But before we went out, for some reason, we went on after them. And of course, we only had that one gold outfit. And they had worn theirs already, so it looked like we were copying off of theirs. Oh, it's like, you know, because it was like, why would you go out with something that you know that you're going to wear? And that's the only outfit we have. I want to be there.
Well, Cindy Birdsong left them to become one of the Supremes. That was bittersweet.
She left and she went to the top female group in the nation at that time.
We were disappointed that something that we knew to be a quartet was not a trio.
Kind of barrier. Yeah. Not to say that we weren't, but, you know, it's, you look at it as your group member. Diana Ross, they're Patti LaBelle. I was very, very much interested in early women because the way I met her was really important to me. I had this beautiful engagement ring in the city. And he said, look, once we get married, Patti, we're going to move to Detroit. I said, I'll do what? Still, I'm not saying that. I think that's what I mean. So I wasn't taking any chances. I said, well, I'm going to bring you to get married. This is definitely not what Patti was up. After we broke up, I'm still with sort of like liking. So he said, well, if he lost out, I'm not. He wined and dined me and dated me. We became tonight.
Sunday, we were married the following Tuesday.
And we went to the Genesis of Peace in Maryland. But they had a big wedding. It was like, let's do it now before I change my mind. So we did it.
Oh, before you change it. During the early years of our marriage, I think the times for the Bluebells were still tough. And by tough, I mean they knew that they sang as well as any of the other groups out there. Could not get a hit record.
interesting that the group went through a major change. They went over to England, and thank God that the brilliant that we went through totally changed the group. First of all, dropped the Blue Velvet and just shortened the name to the Bell, put them up with a new look, and they came back to the States as the Bell, totally changing the face of the music. The costumes were futuristic. They were totally from the future. It was like nothing you had ever seen, and they looked great. Nobody was really ready for three black women to be singing about political issues or relationship issues.
We wanted them to look first and then look. So we got them to watch us with the cable outfits and the chills and the whatever head pieces we had on or whatever. And they would look and say, oh, God, these girls are outrageous. The actors looking at us, they would listen and say, oh, but they're saying something to us. So it was all planned. And it worked. I went to the doctor. She says, you're pregnant. And I said, oh, no, I can't be. So Sarah and Ella were depending on me to perform all the time and be on the road and do our group thing. And they weren't happy about it. And they were saying things in their own way. It made me think that they wanted me to have an abortion. And that's very much that. And I said, yeah, there's no way. I said, I have my baby. The girlfriend worked perfectly. And Carnegie Hall, when I was singing my heart out, almost singing the baby out, he was kicking, kicking, kicking. And I was like 8 months with high heels, 4 inch pumps. But, you know, just looking cute. I think it was filming and working it. I was just having fun. And then he came to the next day. My proudest moment was getting birth to my son, Billy. I was 29 years old. But I was so happy and so proud of him. I call him Zizi, and his name is Zuri. It means beautiful in Swahili.
I think I was about 6 or 7 when I realized that my mom wasn't like all the other moms. And I think my first experience was going to a grocery store. And she wound up getting involved in this grocery store, signing autographs, which I later found out could be signing autographs. And I was like, what are you doing, Mom? Like, all these people were coming up to her. I was like, you know all these people? She was like, no, but they're fans of mine. Fans are like my friends.
She said, yes, Mom. I guess because she traveled and was away from us, that was kind of like that, I wanted to say, for lack of a better word, still not being there.
There's been times where I wanted my mom to be home when I was growing up, but she had to work. She had to work. Oh,
yeah, that was good. I was blessed to have him as the husband and father because he was very father and mother when I was in there. The lady Marmalade song was a gift. I got a call from this gentleman in the neighborhood street. He's from Florida. And he knew that we were on our way to Florida to the court. And we went to his house. Played this song. As soon as it was over, we always knew each other and said it's a hit. The Alan Two song. He produced the four of this. Baby, just go, just go,
like a family breakup. We knew people were going in different directions. finish the show, but it was perfectly clear.
I remember the night that we said goodbye when we got and it's not just me, we didn't see it at all. You know, because even though we knew we had the part, we were so bitter with it. And a lot of guilt was felt by me because I was saying, I feel that I'm going to be the reason that people didn't work us. The lead singer is always like the blame.
When Patty left LaBelle, you know, love Sarah and Nona, love her, love her. But, you know, Patty was where Patty was the first to have a solo album.
People might not believe it, but she was extremely nervous.
I'm afraid to perform on myself because I was always used to having Sarah and Nona back there. I was in front of
you
a solo singer, but that's the way it ended up.
Patty decided to go solo and asked when I worked with her.
I'm honored that that's all been great for me. When she said, you are my friend, I can get choked up. Actually, it's a very emotional song to me. And hearing and seeing the emotion and energy that she puts into that song every time she performs it. I need to carry that. I've always been intrigued with her voice. She has one of the most great voices. Patty's voice is very unique. She has like a 5-octave play. She has quite an ability to hold a note. I don't know how long. I've never tired of it. But she can hold notes quite long. Because I think something in her, she puts all she has into it. And when she holds a note, she does what she has to do to put the emotional connection to it. Bluebells to Pattingbell, the Bluebells to the Bell. I mean, she had 2-3 different careers already that she had put out. I think one solo album. And at that particular time, the people at CBS, I happened to overhear them talking about the sales. And I don't think our sales at that particular time were up to its maximum. So I had asked them, I said, well, listen, let me sign Patty. One of the things that we saw with Patty was to tone her voice down and record her in a middle range. And that middle range was where I thought the real essence of her voice was. If only you knew was her first number one record as a single artist, and I think it helped reestablish her base and her credibility as a single artist.
There were, I think, 4 albums that had moderate success, never anything to like take her to the next level. But we needed to do something to, you know, to draw attention.
Norma, my friend, and I came up with this look one night. It was like a 5-minute costume change. And I had gone out with just a plain little hair. I said, well, let's just push it up. Let's do something. And so she got some pieces and she stuck them in my hair and we sprayed them and went out. We started making our way to the other. She started liking them. And every day she would ask me, she said, Mom, when are you going to make a different one? And I was like, okay, today will be the bucket. Tomorrow will be the tree. The next day will be the leaf. And she just loved it.
The hair style turned a very useful.
Since then, people have been saying, you know, how do you wear that crazy long hair? Put that bucket on your head or whatever.
time I was playing with her, and she decided to pick her shoes up. I can't remember exactly when, but it's been such a long time ago. And it's something like you never know what that is going to do, see, or see. So it was a surprise, but it was a welcome surprise.
My feet were hurting, and I kicked the pumps off, and it felt good. So I just loved it, and so now I take the shoe off, or I take my lashes off and get into the front row. Or I'll roll on the floor if I feel like it's a mess. You know, so I'll do these things because they're part of me. It's a part of me. God has given a special voice, and it's big. It's a big, loud voice. And if you give me a microphone, I'm going to wear it if I can. If it's in the right key, and I don't want to know what love is. If it isn't my key, I want you to share it with me. So I sing. I was accused of stealing the spotlight for dying all the time. I installed none. They gave me a mic and I used it. And I never like to overdo or try to take over anything. And it was said the next day that I don't know about stealing the finale or steal something or what. I didn't steal, take none of that out of the girl. So when they all ask how you're going to do a finale, I'll say no. I don't do it anymore. Because I hate getting a bad rap. And I hate for people to think that I'm doing something and I'm not doing it. This is only a real tip. I don't try to do anything more than anyone else. I just try to do my craft really well. I kept my divorce thought, to myself.
I'm Don. This is my brother's dad. We were adopted by my mother. when my biological mother passed away. Pat Narmstead, my mom's dad now, wanted to adopt myself and Stan. So they asked us to be part of their family. Unhappy, she said, you know, I'm telling everybody, introducing that my son, I'm really happy. And you're calling me Pat. I don't like that, she said. So from then on, I started calling him the idea of four guys in a household where she was clean, that she liked that. She liked it. My mom has never driven. She doesn't want to drive. You know, if she ever gets behind the wheel.
I'll never learn to drive either. Because I'm afraid of who I might hit. I might run over you. I mean, I'm just afraid of myself beyond the wheel. I love cooking people.
I love my mom cooking. I love everything. She makes a triple Zion as I as well. A fried chicken. Very good. And spaghetti.
I'm not a cook, I'm a cooker. I'm a very cook and I'm a thinker.
She always just talked to me like she knew me right off the bat. And she brought us macaroni and cheese and wings, I couldn't believe, for the whole set. You know, so
eager
that she is, she still took care of
her
people.
I made them a lot of cookies because everybody on that set was in the set. They were all hungry, little skinny girls. They needed to eat. I kept my divorce thoughts to myself for 15 years because I said I could never ever let the public know that I have a not happy marriage. And my son, I said, I can't let him think that his mother and father don't get along. So I was lying for 15 years of my life to me.
I would love her to find out what that's like. I think that she's having fun now. I think that she is finding herself, that she is loving who she is, and I think she's loving me.
Now, I just want to just, like, be free. I just want to be on my own, and I am.
When I see her now, I'm just really proud of her, and I'm happy that she is happy for a long, long time.
A legend. People use the word very loosely, but I'm very specific about when I say this word because that's what Patty is.
And the thing that I wish more than anything is that my sisters and my mother and father were here to finally, because my sister always said, you're one bad bee, she used to say. And she said, one day you'll be on the street of Hollywood, you know, with your little star.
Well, I always been a big fan of her. I love her voice and I love her
spirit. You can't pretend in front of the president of the United States, at least I can't. And I'm not going to be cheating, not to my shoes off, because Bill is there. My different had just popped when I was doing my little dress for the book.
She was into it that night. She was into it. And then she brought the house down. She completely stole the show.
And the Grammy goes to Patti LaBelle.
People remember Patti LaBelle when they hear her once.
Because my
house never forget Patti can just about do anything that she wants to do. Is that ready for Patti's sister, soul sister? That's Patti LaBelle. She's a soul sister.
I never see myself as him. I was sane and sane, kicking off the shoes and probably in a wheelchair, but kicking the shoes off from the wheelchair, and then rolling the wheelchair on the floor. That's a visual, isn't it? That's the way I'm going to do it. That's what I'm talking about. That's it.
And I am your host, Dr. Walter Dina. You have been listening to two separate entertainers. The first entertainer was telling about the hard times she had during the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and the 60s.
As ago.
60s, 70s, 80s, all the way to the present time. She did not have to go through what our previous performer had to go through. She didn't have to go through the problems of segregation. That had already passed by. But she did go through a different kind of entertainment torment, leaving the group that she sang with. I remember the group, because at that particular time, I was singing at the Apollo. But I remember the group that she sang with. It was outrageous. Playing the bell breaks the house down, whatever she sings. She has been given a gift of God with the voice that she has. What a fantastic sound she has been able to muster. Even when she was much younger, you never walk alone. It was hard to be able to hold back and keep back or hold down a person with so much talent that came to sing. I'm very, very happy to know that she's happy now. She's no longer married, even though the person that she married was always support her, and who still loves her. And in a way, I think she still loves him. She just needs, like she said, freedom to go and do what she wants to do when she feels like doing it. So, I don't know whether or not you heard too much of the show because I didn't have the complete speaker on throughout the show. Then you don't hear too much of anything. But we did get through this show. And it's now time for us to say goodnight and goodbye. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dina, and hopefully you'll listen to us again on Monday. Bye.